Hi, everybody. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for inviting me to Seattle. Nice to see you all tonight. Compassion, love, what could be better? Who doesn't want it? You can go anywhere, and not everybody will necessarily be compassionate and loving. But it's very unusual to find someone who will argue against these things, right? Whatever their politics, whatever their point of view, most people will feel that love and compassion is a good thing. It's a good thing, something that we would all aspire to and be interested in. And I think that a lot of us didn't realize this in the beginning when we began practicing Buddhism in all its various forms. I don't know what we thought we were doing exactly, but we didn't realize that liberation really is liberation from yourself. That's the problem, isn't it? And liberation from yourself means liberation from excessive self-concern, which means being concerned for others. Actually, it's a great thing to be concerned for others and not to be so concerned for yourself. It turns out, oddly enough, that if you want to be happy, that is the best way to be happy. For you, selfishly, to be happy, the best way is to have less self-concern and more concern for others. The more concern you have for others, the bigger your heart is, and the more you care for others and the more love there is, the happier you are and the less problem you have in your life. And it does turn out, in fact, that this is in Mahayana Buddhism exactly the idea, that we are going to be liberated from ourselves and liberated to love. And it turns out that if you love, the easy part is how nice it feels to love, right? That's the easy part. The hard part is that if you love, you're going to be loving impermanent creatures who will suffer difficulty. And if you don't have the capacity to feel their suffering and care about their suffering, well, in the end, you can't really love them, really. You're loving a fiction of your own devising. So in order to love, you have to have compassion. You have to develop compassion. And it turns out that that's not so easy to do. Because naturally, we all want to go in the other direction when there's pain. Nobody wants to go toward pain and suffering. Everybody wants to go away from pain and suffering. But compassion requires that you are willing to go toward pain and suffering. And love requires compassion. So it turns out this is a little more complicated than we thought. But it's also beautiful. To care for the suffering of others is not something negative or difficult. In the end, it's something beautiful. It's something that we all want, and it's something that we're built to feel and to be able to do. But probably it takes some training, some effort, some thought. So there's teachings in Buddhism about this, and this book of mine, Training in Compassion, is about a particular text, which has the purpose of helping us to learn how to overcome the barriers within ourselves toward compassion. So over the weekend, that's what I want to do, is really go into some detail with the book, and we'll probably do some sitting and some talking and some discussion in small groups, some guided meditations, to try to find out how we can actually activate a process within our own spiritual life of generating compassion, that this actually could be done. Because people think, well, I'm a compassionate person, I'm not a compassionate person, I'm this, I'm that. But actually, you could cultivate compassion. You could open up your heart more. You could learn how. But I want to talk about that a little differently tonight, if you don't mind. Because the Shambhala guys, you know, the ones who put out the magazine and have the press, they said, knowing this book, they said, we're thinking about anger. And anger is such a big problem for us as individuals and for the world. And we would like to have you write something for us about how this compassion text can be used specifically to help us work with our anger. Anger kind of has a way of getting in the way of compassion, doesn't it? It's one of the barriers to compassion. So would you write something for us about how to apply this text on compassion specifically? Oh, hi. There you are.
Here I am.
Yeah. Specifically in the case of anger. So I said, sure. You know, I always, whenever they say write something, I say, why not? That's a good idea. So I wrote it. And I, you know, since I just wrote it, I'm kind of interested in it. So I thought I would share what I wrote with you. I was working on it on the plane and trying to polish it and make it sound all good. So how about if I test it out on you? So, okay, because who knows? Maybe somebody here has gotten angry once or twice. Possible. So that's what I thought I would do this evening. And if it turns out that it's, you know, falls flat or it's boring or something, we'll switch and we'll do something else. Let's try this, though. So this is an essay called Acupressure Point of the Heart. Acupressure Point of the Heart. You can all hear me okay, right? No? Speak up. Move the mic up. Okay. Thank you for telling me. Yeah. How's that? Any better? No. Is there a... operating. It's just recording. So there isn't a mic. So then I'll talk louder. Yeah, and if my voice falls off, somebody can let me know. You're the official voice monitor. Okay, thank you. Okay, so acupressure point of the heart. Anger is impressive. It flares up, taking over almost completely, controlling our feelings, our viewpoint, our words and deeds. The body tenses. The face turns red. The heart, the mind, race. We feel like we're ready to explode. Anger is a very unpleasant experience. And yet some people like anger, because all that intensity can be intoxicating and even addicting. Plus, anger makes you intimidating. People can be afraid of you, which can be very flattering. Plus, they might even give you what you want. So there are people who like anger. For most people, though, this kind of full-blown anger is not a daily occurrence. But there are many milder forms of anger that appear whenever we're slighted, even if we're only slightly slighted, whenever we're disrespected, whenever we're frustrated, whenever, in fact, we are thwarted in any way in what we expect or desire. When that happens, every day, we have some small flare-up of anger. So it seems in this way that anger is not just one emotion among many. There's something really basic about it. Because we organize the world around our self-interest. Naturally, of course, we do that. We want things to go our way, not somebody else's way. And because, just as naturally, the world and other people do not always cooperate with this understandable, if unrealistic, request of ours, we are very likely to be at least a little angry a lot of the time. The closer you look in anger, the more tricky and deceptive it seems. We know that anger can be there when we don't even experience it. Somebody might say to you, I'm not angry at all. And they might mean it when they say that. And yet we look at them and we can see that they're pretty angry. I mean, it's very odd that we could be angry without feeling angry. But this happens. And the converse can also be true. We could be feeling angry, but the anger is actually a cover-up for some other powerful emotion, usually fear or grief or sorrow, some other powerful emotion that we don't want to feel. So we get angry. So to practice with anger, to make anger a part of our spiritual practice, rather than simply continuing to be a victim of anger, is to make the effort to respect and understand anger, to be willing to look more deeply at the complex of negative emotions that naturally arise as part of our human condition, and to take responsibility for these emotions so that maybe we can begin to do something a little more creative with them. In most classical Buddhist discussions of anger, anger is viewed entirely negatively. And when you read these teachings, you get the feeling that we shouldn't be angry. We should be nice. And if we are angry, we're somehow failing in our spiritual practice. To be sure, anger really is a problem. Even if we're someone who likes being angry, it's a problem, because to be addicted to the rush of anger is actually really bad for your health. And being an intimidating person is not nearly as good as being a loved and a respected person. So yes, anger is a problem that we need to deal with. On the other hand, if somehow we could channel and purify anger's strong emotional energy and not be pushed around by its irrationality and destructiveness, we might actually be able to use it as an ally to help us to work for the good. But there's something else about anger that could be even more helpful than this. Anger is information. Anger is telling us something about who we are and what is on our mind and in our heart. It's just like physical pain. Just as physical pain is negative, because it hurts, it's also positive, because it's the body's way of protecting itself by indicating that something is wrong and where something is wrong. So in just that same way, anger can show us something crucial about our emotional life that we may need to really know in order to become healthy people. So anger is an indicator. It's telling us something here needs attention. Something here needs investigation. If we're angry, it's because we're thwarted or frustrated or afraid somehow. And maybe we don't know it. And we should know it so that we can shift and grow. Almost always in life, our various fears and frustrations and challenges signal times and opportunities for growth and change, if only we will look them in the face. And when we're willing to do that, we will see things differently, more accurately. Instead of avoiding fears and frustrations or beating our heads against them in anger as we lash out at ourselves or others or the world in general, we can pass through them and become larger, more inclusive, and more compassionate people. There's a wonderful Zen poem called Tore Enji's Bodhisattva's Vow. And it's got a beautiful line that I often refer to. It says, "Then on each moment's flash of thought, there will grow a lotus flower, and each lotus flower will reveal a Buddha." And the reason I like that line so much is because once I was in a retreat where we were chanting that every day, and I had a really big insight about this. I realized how absolutely and stunningly true this line is. I realized that every thought and every emotion that I had, including the most negative ones, the most painful ones, the ones I was desperately trying to get rid of, every single one was a lotus flower once I got to the bottom of it. Once I got past my old habit of aversion and desire, I saw that every thought and every emotion has a Buddha in it, something valuable and worthwhile and even beautiful. If I was willing, with patience, to stay with it long enough without reacting and spinning around as I usually did. And this is no less true of anger. Anger really is a lotus flower with a Buddha sitting in it to awaken us. And we can trust our anger and we can practice with it. Buddhism is justly valued for its many effective and sensible ways of working with anger. All these ways depend on basic mindfulness, which is the ability to create the inner space necessary to be fully present with an emotion. Strong emotions, especially negative ones, like greed, anger, jealousy, and so on, do spin us around before we even know we're feeling them. We're already blaming, yelling, acting out unwisely. Mindfulness gives us the chance to be present with an emotion before we start spinning, or, if need be, while we are spinning. To be mindful is to relax and allow consciousness to open around an object. Mindfulness is a soft light illuminating what is there with honesty and simplicity. And when we meditate, we're practicing mindfulness, whether it's mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of sounds, or mindfulness of thoughts and feelings arising and passing away. We're training ourselves in a generous presence. Mindfulness is subtle and radical. Getting up from the meditation cushion, mindfulness continues during the day as we practice patient awareness of what is going on. Rather than being propelled and likely blinded by what we think we want, which is usually what goes on during the day, with some mindfulness we're paying attention. We're being present. We're willing and interested to see more widely and openly what is happening. And such seeing actually changes what we experience. It changes how we behave, and ultimately it changes the sorts of things that will happen. So mindfulness is this radical act of simply being with what happens in the faith that our ability to do this will naturally change things. All Buddhist practices in working with anger depend on this mindfulness. But there are more active and intentional practices that support and are supported by mindfulness to work with anger. So as I said in the beginning, I've been recently working with these Lojong teachings, which is mentioned in the title of the book, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lojong. Lojong is a Tibetan word that means mind training, or heart training, training the heart, training the mind. And it's a general category of teachings about emotions. Most of these teachings are about how to transform greed, anger, jealousy, and so on into love, compassion, sympathy. So I've been practicing with the most famous of all Lojong texts, which is called 7 Points of Mind Training. And this text, which is what this book is based on, is got 7 points and 59 slogans. That's the text. 7 points under which are organized 59 slogans. So the slogans in the text are memorable, sometimes humorous aphorisms that point us in an advantageous spiritual direction. Here's the way I have worked with these slogans. I choose one that interests me. I write it on a card, or I write it in my notebook. Maybe I copy it over and over again many times. Maybe I journal about it. I almost make it like it's a physical object, like the letters of the words are like a physical object. So it goes beyond advice. Then I repeat the slogan to myself silently as I exhale on my meditation cushion. I breathe into it. I stay with it until all my ideas about it become boring. And the only thing left is the slogan itself, as if it were like a flashing light in my mind. And if you practice with it like that, it has a way of popping up every now and then when you're not expecting it, because you've worked at it, see? It'll pop up. It'll remind you of your practice. It'll remind you of the necessity of working with your emotions. Pop, you know, all of a sudden, pop, there it is again. Substituting for the usual stupid, crappy thoughts that you would have had otherwise. And little by little, the slogan itself works on you. It works its way into your thinking and into your conduct. So now I'm going to really briefly, and I'm going to, on the, over the weekend, we're going to, this is what we're going to go into, but very briefly now, what I want to do is, just so you know the overview, tell you what the 7 points are, very briefly, and then I'm going to take a few slogans and talk about them briefly, each one briefly, and how we could use this slogan to work with our anger. So that's the rest of what I'm going to say. Okay? So here are the 7 points. Point number one. And is it, this is, I've given myself the liberty of, I always do this, you know, of putting the things in my own words so that it's more understandable to me and hopefully to my reader. So some of these, if you're used to this text, you might notice that I've put things in a little different ways. Anyway, first point, resolve to begin. And this point is an exploration of your deepest motivations. Because a lot of times we do things without really exploring. Are we serious about this? You know, how many times have you started something and it didn't last more than a day or a week? Because apparently you weren't serious enough about it. So the first thing you have to do is explore how serious you are. Look at your motivation. Second point, training in empathy and compassion. And these are deep meditations to cultivate absolute and ordinary compassion and caring. And the difference between absolute and ordinary compassion and caring, not tonight, some other, maybe over the weekend. 3, transform bad circumstances into the path. This is a process of learning how to make use of life's small and large misfortunes to increase your faith and understanding, rather than what usually happens, something goes wrong, end of path, end of practice, I don't have time for it now, I'm in a crisis. Instead of that, make use of these crises for your practice. 4, make practice your whole life. See through the undermining concept that spiritual practice is something over there. It's a very nice thing to do when you have time for it. It's pleasant and nice. Life is over here. The real world is over here. It's two different things. No. Make practice your whole life. No difference between spiritual practice and living as a human being, which is the truth, really. 5, assess and extend. This is how to monitor your efforts so you can keep on track. When you get off track, get back on. Because you do get off track. We all do. 6, the discipline of relationship. Since relationships are actually the main site for spiritual practice, you need to learn how to start practicing, doing spiritual practice in the middle of your relationships instead of the opposite, which is so painful, right? And the last point, 7, living with ease in a crazy world. And this is just a whole bunch of miscellaneous slogans to help us cope in the world we live in. The world is crazy. I think we could all, those of us in the room who are psychologists, could make a diagnosis. And I think it would be, we could come up with several diagnoses for the craziness of the world. But we have to live in this world. And there's a way of doing it without ourselves being crazy. So now, that's the map of the whole path of the slogans. And now I would like to take a few slogans under 6, the discipline of relationship, that might be helpful in working with anger. So I'm just going to tell you the slogan and talk about it a little bit. Just imagine going through the whole process that I just described a moment ago with these slogans. Then they would really work for you. But we don't have time for that, so I'll just say something about each slogan. And the ones I'm going to talk about are, don't figure others out. Work with your biggest problems first. Abandon hope. Don't poison yourself. And don't be so predictable. So those are slogans from all listed under the sixth point, the discipline of relationship. Okay, don't figure others out. Think about how much we're constantly talking about our friends and relatives, constantly analyzing the things they say and do, constantly like figuring them out and sizing them up, as if we and our friends who are talking together actually know what makes them tick. But just as you probably don't appreciate very much being reduced to this cartoon-like and very likely uncomplimentary version of yourself, I bet anything they don't like it that much either. And the fact is, any version of who you, they, or anyone else is always incorrect. All you have to do is sit on your meditation cushion for half an hour to notice how many contradictions, unacknowledged issues, and unfinished business is all in you. So much so that it would be hard to precisely define honestly and realistically what your character is, because there are so many good sides to you and so many bad sides to you. And others are probably just like that too. And that means that no one has the capacity to figure others out. And yet we do it all the time. And we think we have other people figured out. And then based on this mischaracterization, we go forth and we relate to them. How is that going to go? Now, we do this especially with the people we're angry at, right? We know exactly what kind of people they are. And we know that they are absolutely unworthy of our regard. And they are very worthy, richly worthy, of our antipathy and our resentment. Why would we want to give such a person the benefit of the doubt? Never, never. And yet the truth is, we have no idea what is going on inside this person. We have no idea what really makes him or her tick, why he or she did the things she did. In other words, you can count on the fact that when you're angry with someone, you're angry at a fantasy, a phantom of your own imagination. This is really the truth. Think about it. Don't figure others out. Okay, next one. Work with your biggest problems first. Which is, of course, the opposite of what we all would like to do. Let's take on something pretty easy. And little by little, we'll work our way up to the hard things. But have you noticed that when you do this, you never seem to get to the hard things? Have you noticed this? So this slogan says, don't do it that way. Whatever is most difficult for you, go there. Be courageous and go there right away. This is going to take all the mindfulness you have been able to cultivate from your time on the meditation cushion and more than that. It's going to take forbearance. One of the most powerful and least appreciated of all spiritual practices. Forbearance is the capacity to patiently stay with something unpleasant or difficult. To just stay there with it and face it, rather than do what comes naturally for every one of us. To go somewhere else, think about something else, distract ourselves somehow. Forbearance requires that we develop the capacity in our body, in our breath, and in our heart, to stand firm and aware just with the emotion and without acting, at least for now. When we're angry, we don't practice forbearance, right? We're right away lashing out. But the truth is, most people are not quite courageous enough to actually lash out at the people they're angry at. So instead of this, we gossip, we take pot shots, or a lot of times we lash out at someone nearby who's a safer person to lash out at, somebody who we know loves us and probably will tolerate us. So we take it out on our friends. Or, if we don't do that, we just grouse and feel indignant in the privacy of our own minds. All of these activities do nothing to bother the person we're angry with, but they hurt us and maybe our friends quite a bit. That's the opposite of this slogan. Work with your biggest problems first means that when we're angry, we right away turn toward the anger. We feel it in our body. We feel it in our breathing. We feel it in our racing thoughts. And we don't leap over all of this right away to blame and recrimination or distraction. Instead, we know we're angry. It's uncomfortable, but there it is. And we feel the anger as real and as valuable. We stay with the experience. And when we're able to do that, we can calm down and we can see more what's really going on. And eventually, we will discover the best course of action before we've gotten ourselves entangled and enmeshed in multiple problems, as so often happens. This all makes sense, doesn't it? But usually we don't do it. Right? So simple. All we have to do is do it. The next one, abandon hope. What? Don't we want to be hopeful? Don't we want to hope that tomorrow is going to be better than today? Don't we want to hope at least that our spiritual endeavors will pay off somehow? Don't we want to hope that our anger will someday transform? But if you investigate hope, you see how counterproductive it can be. To hope usually means to reject the experience of this moment. Hope can actually be a kind of cowardice. Rather than face what's going on right now, why don't I instead focus my attention on later, when things will be much more pleasant than they are at this moment? In the case of anger, maybe we have some hope that internally the anger will somehow dissolve, or that externally the person we're angry at will see the error of their ways and apologize to us and make amends. Or maybe we're hoping that our Buddhist practice will somehow cause everything to turn out all right in the end. But such hope actually gets in the way of the desired outcome. Let's be honest. Anger is really hard to overcome. It's not so hard to, sublimate or push off into a corner, but to really overcome anger is hard. And wishing will not make it go away. And the job of seeing through anger takes a lot longer than you think. Sometimes you think, I finally finished with this. And then something happens and you realize, I'm not. So hope can breed laziness and even impatience. When patience, which requires courage, is what we need the most. So internally, you really do need to have the commitment to go on working with your anger forever. You even have to learn how to take some pleasure and delight in this work. Because if anger is something that is entirely negative, that a really nice person like you shouldn't be feeling, and that you're hoping that your spiritual practice will swiftly purify your heart so that you'll never have to feel it again, well, the shock and disappointment that you'll feel when this turns out to be not the case will be a major impediment, really. So also, working with anger in the hope that this good work will somehow cause the other person to be different is unlikely to pan out. Now, of course, it actually does happen sometimes. It does happen that when we soften inside toward the other person, they do too. That does happen. On the other hand, it's very probable that this other person has a life that's bigger than just our interactions with that other person. it's possible that the causes of that person's anger are deeper and more extensive than just the interaction between yourself and that person. So we really do have to abandon hope and simply take on the practice of working with our anger without expectations that others will be nicer to us if we do so. In fact, our efforts will pay off, but only when we stop hoping that they will. It's odd but true. Next one. Don't poison yourself. Poison, in this case, means self-centeredness. I think this is changing really fast in our world. But it is still the case that in the world we live in, the idea of looking out exclusively for yourself is taken as a virtue. Of course you should stick up for yourself. Of course you should compete against the many others who are vying with you for a place in the sun. That's how we're all taught. And to be sure, each of us does have to be responsible for ourselves and not expect others to take care of us. But at the same time, it's really obvious that excessive self-concern is counterproductive to oneself. It leads to paranoia, greed, envy, and all kinds of bad personal and social consequences. The antidote to this kind of poison is a wise concern for others that will balance self-concern. Such balance is not a mathematical equation. It's not a tortured compromise. It's a naturally wise way of living. Take, for example, a parent who is primarily concerned for his or her child's welfare. But without some healthy self-concern, concern for the child can't be sustained. If a parent doesn't take care of his health, his psychological well-being, which requires a modicum of happiness, what kind of a job is he going to do caring for his child? How effective is a grumpy, sick, depressed mother caring for her child? So self-concern is not bad. It's bad when it's practiced exclusively for its own sake, and it's good when it's practiced for the sake of others. It poisons us, and we become literally poisoned with self-obsession, as so many people are. So to practice this slogan is to notice that when we become defensive and aggressive, it's usually because of the poison of self-concern. Imagine how different your experience of anger would be if in a moment of anger, in that very moment, all of a sudden it popped into your mind, "Don't poison yourself!" Imagine that. And in that moment, you turned your attention to others, maybe even to the person in front of you that you're angry with. What if you wondered how this was for him in that moment? Totally change the picture, wouldn't it? Yeah. And the last one. Don't be so predictable. This slogan, in a way, is the flip side of don't figure others out. In other words, don't be so sure you have yourself figured out either. basically, to do spiritual practice in a serious way is to cultivate a sense of openness and possibility in relation to others, but also and especially in relation to yourself. Remember what I quoted for you earlier. In each moment's flash of thought, there's a lotus flower that will reveal a Buddha. Most of us have plenty of evidence over a lifetime of experience that we are this way or that way. I'm an angry person. I'm a compassionate person. I'm cheerful, phlegmatic, depressed, repressed, expressive. I'm extroverted. I'm introverted. We all have ourselves pretty well figured out. And all this is fair enough. We do have genetic predispositions, and we have all been formed by a culture, a family, and habits. That conditioning doesn't dissolve or disappear just because we think it ought to. So that's true. But also, we are living creatures who have the capacity to respond creatively in any given moment to what happens. And we all know this. There's nobody here who believes that they are absolutely doomed 100% of the time to always react the same way when something happens. We know it's not true. Life is various. And we have free will. And we do change. The whole idea of spiritual cultivation, not to mention education, is that we can and we will change if we pay attention and put our mind to it. But here's the sneaky thing. Most of us have a commitment to proving the opposite. Most of us actually take pride in being the way we say and think we are. Even when we say we want to change, a deeper look shows us that, well, yes, it's true, we really do want to change. Unfortunately, it's also true that we are very committed to and also very comfortable with the way we have been defining ourselves all this time. And so, in fact, we're actively and sneakily working against the very changes we so fervently want to make in our lives. I don't know if this makes sense to you, but I've seen this in many, many, many people, including this one. Don't Be So Predictable invites us to examine this sneaky phenomenon and to be honest about it. To notice, let's say in the case of anger, our generic response, whatever it is, and pay close attention to it. Not simply mindlessly repeat it time after time. Let's say, for instance, we're someone who, when we get angry, right away we clam up. So when that happens, we observe ourselves doing this. And we investigate. Is this an old habit? Is this still me? Have I outgrown this, but I forgot to notice? Or, where does this habit come from? Or, how do I feel about it? Do I like this? Do I not like it? Or, do I actually take comfort in it, uncomfortable as it is? And how does it feel in my body and in my breathing? And what kind of thoughts come up when I get angry and clam up this way? And the most important question, Would something right now, something else, be possible? Could we be a little more creative and a little less lazy in the way we respond? So challenging ourselves in this open-ended and curious way, without expectations or mandates that it's supposed to be this way or that way, is the way we practice this slogan. So insofar as anger presents us forcefully with the possibility that we could challenge our usual way of doing business, it could be a very helpful reminder of who we are now and who we might become. Anger is actually an acupressure point in our heart. It might feel sore and raw when it is inadvertently bumped, but that's a good thing. If we know how to be patient with the pain and how to gently and skillfully apply some massage, it could be a path of healing. Anger itself could be our best tool for healing not only anger, but our whole lives. So thanks for being a guinea pig for my essay. Nobody's read it yet. I'll send it to the Shambhala people on Monday. I got to squiggle and write in all on the plane. I think we should take a break, okay, of about 5 or 10 minutes. And then anybody who would like to hang out and discuss, we'll do that. Thank you very much for listening, and have a good break.